Okay, are you there?
I'm still here.
Well, that was easy. Okay, so this is a Grand Canyon Historical Society oral history program recording. Today is the 13th of August, 2017, and this is a interview, the second in a two-part interview with Steve Stork, S-T-O-R-C-K, and Tom Martin, and we're doing this by phone today. In our first interview, we talked about your growing up outside of Washington in a very rural environment, and going through multiple universities and ending up with a PhD, certainly looking at recreational management, and now working for West Virginia University Tech. Steve, you just completed a Grand Canyon River trip, rowing a boat through Grand Canyon. I wanted to back up a little bit as we start this. Can you tell me when Grand Canyon first kind of got into your consciousness as a place?
I think I shared earlier when I was in elementary school, a member of the Canoe Cruise Association, for some reason, was invited to my elementary school. I think I was in second grade. I was probably 7 at the time. And showed a homemade movie of their trip through the Grand Canyon, a group trip. And I guess it was an early trip in the late 60s, early 70s. It was a humorous trip. It had some logistics beforehand. But I just remember, the white water and the feeder streams, particularly Havasu and little Colorado, of them, riding in-flight pads down and meeting some folks at Phantom Ranch, and just the grandeur of it. And for some reason in my mind, early on, I was like, that's what I wanted to do. And I had talked with my father about going there sometime and backpacking, and that never transpired. Early in my marriage, in the early mid-80s, I had the pleasure of backpacking there. Skipped one. In 1977, my family did a driving tour across the United States, and we stopped at the South Rim. It just fed my fascination and wonder of, what was down there, that river that was calling for even then, and whether I would ever get on there. And then hiking down in the 80s, again, seeing the river and wishing I wasn't on my feet, I was in a boat. But still enjoying it and a fascinating place it was. But then when I in my early career with colleges and running outdoor programs, I started doing some oar rigging. And the Grand Canyon is always that sort of the ultimate, for me anyway, of where you might go. And I always dreamt of it, but probably never thought it would happen until my friend Kirk asked me one day. He goes, "Hey, what about applying to the Grand Canyon?" And I was like, "Well, it's the last thing on my bucket list that I created when I was 14. I'd be a fool not to want to try. I figured it'd be a few years, but we were lucky enough to get a permit in 2.
How do you know Kirk?
I worked for the National. I needed a break from outdoor rec for a while, and I needed to put some kids through college. So I worked for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration as an environmental educator. And Kirk was there as a fellow. They have had a program where science teachers, could come to NOAA and help train other teachers in NOAA sciences, and that we just happened to land in the same office and hit it off by our common interest, not only in environmental education, but in paddling.
Nice.
And we've had a friendship ever since.
Had you kayaked with him on rivers before?
Oddly enough, we talked for years about it, and while we worked together, which was only a couple of years, we never paddled together. And then afterwards,
right.
We did get together, and we paddled once, and then once we went together on this trip. I mean, we knew we had similar interests and similar perspectives on safety and difficulty of river and river running. But once we got this permit, we paddled together about 5 or 6 times on some different rivers just in getting ready, and that, again, bonded our relationship even closer. So
nice. And then did you apply to the waiting list or did you apply to the lottery?
Over the years I had looked at the waiting list and always thought that it was out of reach, so I never applied. So we applied to the lottery. Kirk the first time, probably in 2013, he was going to be the trip leader and I was the PATL. So we both had the 5 points. And then we didn't get it that year, so we got a 6 point when we applied 2 years later. And then I paid the fee and kind of flip-flopped, and I was the trip leader and he was the assistant. And that's when we got it.
And I'll point out for the transcriptionist that PATL stands for Potential Alternate Trip Leader.
Yes. And I was under the impression that our points were pooled together, but later had read and in our discussions as well, found that it was whoever had the lowest number of points would be the number of points that were entered in the lottery. And, we had the same number of points as neither of us had ever been before. So
got it.
We both had 6 points. So,
did you win your first choice or your second, third, fourth, or fifth choice in the lottery for a date to launch?
Yeah, I should have looked it up. I don't know.
Okay.
What I did was I looked through the materials they had sent, and I looked for odd days because I had more flexibility than I thought most people might. So I looked for odd days that had low application, a Monday or some point in time that would carry you over a couple of weekends where people might not want to do on their vacations. So I'm pretty sure it was my third date that I put in there, but I'd have to confirm that.
Okay. And then what happened?
And then we're like, oh boy, we don't know anything about the Grand Canyon. We better get some people on board that know this river. And so we, Kirk was originally from Texas and knew a bunch of people in Austin who he had paddled and knew that they had paddled the Grand Canyon before. So he had contacted a couple of his friends, and one couldn't go. They had just led a trip last year, and the other hadn't been in about 15 years. And he goes, absolutely, I want to go. And we had decided already we wanted it to be a family-style trip, not a party trip and not just a bunch of adults. We wanted to have multi-generations because we're all getting a little older, and we wanted to pass that experience on to our kids. So David Abel, wanted to go with his sons who are just finishing college, and he may not get to do his trip again. And he knew Dwayne White. I'm not sure if you and he were familiar with one another, but he asked. He said, "Well, what do you think if we invited Dwayne and Tom to go with us?" And I had no hesitation, to be honest. It was like, well, these are the folks that know this river probably better than anybody, and who are we to invite them? But, he said, please do. And we were fortunate enough to get, yourself and Dwayne to join the trip. Although I planned a trip to Austin to purchase a raft for the trip, but also to meet Dwayne. And I think he wanted to kind of check me out to see what kind of person I was and what kind of trip it might be and who I was inviting. And David was there, and Sam, who had also gone with us, was at the meeting, and Dwayne's wife, Barb. And it was about an hour long at the restaurant where David Abel worked. And at the end, somebody kind of whispered to me, I think you passed the test.
Well, the question I have for you is, meaning did they pass the test? Which is a sideways way of asking. Besides a family, what do you think composes a good group of people to boat with for essentially almost 3 weeks in the heat, in the desert, in what could be considered very trying situations?
Yeah, I mean, I've worked in the adventure industry for a long time, and oddly enough, I am not a big risk taker. maybe that's why I've survived in this industry. But so for me, a common philosophy on risk management was probably highest in my experience level, comfort, knowledge of the river. That kind of came first. I think if you have that, you can. Hopefully I still have a successful trip. Personality and interaction is next. Are people easygoing? What are their philosophies of life? Are they heavy partiers? Are they, looking for that natural experience and appreciation of the resource itself? And that's what I found with that group. Was at least at the core of what everyone agreed to was, it was about the river, about a safe trip through the river, and about keeping us together as a group and keeping that as an ongoing piece to have success. And I was very comfortable with that. Particularly, I was inviting family members to go on the trip that didn't paddle, and I was a little concerned about that. For their safety, but also on how they would interact with others, and the group was very welcoming to that concept to introduce new people to the river and to the canyon. So it all seemed to be going okay.
What did you think about the pre-planning? Had you guys thought it through a little bit before you joined the lottery? Okay, we're going to need food and boats and shuttles and all this stuff, or was it, let's just go for the permit. If we get the permit, we'll sort it out downstream from there.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, I've planned trips for 30 years, so I kind of know what it takes to plan trips, and I've planned 5 and 6 day extended river trips. Like, I kind of knew that part of it. For this one, just because I figured it would be 4 or 5 years till we got a permit, I didn't think much about it. And I didn't really think, I thought a little bit about, the only time I had was a summer trip, and I was certainly concerned about hot weather and monsoons and higher water. But it was the only time that we had to do it. Yeah, once the permit came in, those concerns jumped even higher on my list of, okay, how are we going to pull this off now that we have this? And I just started a new job as well, so I was balancing quite a few things. And I didn't know how much, particularly with folks like yourself and Dwayne and others that we had on the trip who had done this many times. I was the designated trip leader from the Park Service's standpoint, but, it was a bit of a dance with, I didn't really have the experience to be a trip leader on this particular trip, but I was designated that. And how would that dance work out with folks who had done this before, and how to incorporate those their ideas and planning with also my need as a little OCD, to have the kind of detail that I like in a plan. And I'm a collaborative person, and I understood my limitations in doing this trip, and it was really nice to be able to have folks that were open about sharing what they had without too much ownership of it, that it became group ownership, which really worked out well, and I was really happy that happened.
What else worked well on the front end planning? And I'm going to then ask what didn't work on the front end planning.
Kirk and I had actually met kind of on a monthly basis the first few months, just kind of talking about the group, talking about who's involved, and building the whole 16. We had some gaps there, and then we just decided to try this sort of online. Skype session. We had some issues with the voice part of it, but it was really kind of a neat opportunity. That, plus my trip down there, I think that trip down there to meet some folks in person was really created some quick bonds. Hmm. Those two things together, I think, really helped solidify that this was a group that could work together. And, you know, we had questions, we had some humor, really different ideas, but that blended, and I started feeling a bit more comfortable about that.
Cool.
Having communications with folks individually, so I could ask questions and get the wisdom, and then, you know, nobody said many of my questions were stupid or, you know, or why are you asking that? We already know how to do that. And it was very open communications. And I think that was really key to bringing a lot of things together. And it just continued. And I think we were just fortunate. You never know what the chemistry of a group will be. And I think we were just fortunate that continued to grow and be functional and supportive. So it's very unique.
Right. Certainly, chemistry, logistics, sorting out boats and people, lots of moving parts to that. What didn't work as you tried to put that together?
We had a couple of bumps with, one or two individual personalities. We had a couple of people drop out, which we had to fill those spaces, and that worked surprisingly easily. I'd heard some horror stories of other trips that had major conflict within people. We just didn't have that. We lucked into, you know, other members of the trip having friends. Mike Smith ended up being able to come on the trip. He was one of our original invitees. We had some folks get injured over the course of 2 years, and I really wanted to have a stronger kayaking group as support, and that sort of trickled away towards the end. Although we did fine, it didn't have the safety support that I would have liked, per se, in terms of the experience base. A little tweaks with the shuttle, and I appreciated your work on the shuttle, but, you know, some folks who we thought were included in the conversation on the shuttle sort of jumped in towards the end and said, hey, wait a minute, you know, I want a shuttle driver. And I was like, well, we had already talked about that. But so there was some, you know, there was some asynchronous parts to the conversation where we thought we included people or tried to include people, and then they sort of jump back in late in the game. And, you know, I'm not a pushover, but I'm a pretty adaptive person and try to incorporate people so they can meet their own goals. And I maybe gave up a few of mine, but I think food planning was another one. Food to me is a make or break on a trip. And I certainly appreciated the experience that went into that. I tried to hold some veto power over some of the food, and hopefully made a little influence, because I want to make sure everybody that I knew, you know, could get, you know, could be full at the end of the day.
Yes.
Looking forward to it. So, yeah, those are some things. But I think, you know, as a coordinator, I don't really think of myself as a trip leader, but as a coordinator of a community, you know, there's compromise that needs to occur. And, you know, at some point, I just had to say to myself, well, is that worth a battle? And potentially, you know, dividing some people in the group, or is that something that you can live with, and as long as you can have some influence in it, it will make, you know, people feel that they're contributing to the community and taking an ownership of part of it that you don't necessarily need. And so it was a little challenge for myself in terms of how to, you know, sort of facilitate a process, which is what I felt like I was doing. I'm not sure if that's what I was doing, but I did feel like, you know, I kind of had to massage the crowd a little bit to get what I wanted out of it, but also make them or allow them to get what they wanted out of it. And I think we did okay there.
You had mentioned when we talked in the first interview about two different styles of trip leading. One was the communal style, and then the other was, if I remember right, an individual style. Is that right?
Yeah, there's some terms for it. That it primarily comes from my sort of my work in designing and building student activity outdoor leadership outdoor programs. And there's a leader-led model, which is where there's sort of a central person who coordinates and you know, organizes and coordinates and makes the primary decisions for an activity. And then there is, I forget the term for the other, sorry.
The communal based?
Where decisions are more centralized. You know, it's not laissez-faire, but it's, you know, groups and the leader, if there is a named leader, is more of a facilitator who just raises the questions of what decisions need to be made or things happen more organically. In that, I've never been very comfortable in that second format because I'm not a control freak, I don't think, but I know my own approaches to risk, and my comfort zone is fairly small, and I've done a lot of work in academic work, but also personal work in thinking about risk thresholds, which is a term that I use, where, you know, what are individual and group thresholds to risk-taking. And in a leader-led format, the leader sort of establishes those. And you never take risk out of adventure activities. They wouldn't be adventure activities, but you don't want to because that's part of the draw and it's part of the growth that people, you know, get during an activity. And they're inherent in the environments that you go in. So you'll never do that, but there are ways to manage that. And in the more community type of programs, you know, people are more free to take their own level of risk, and the only thing you can do is sort of, as a facilitator, is to try to make people aware that, hey, you know, you still are a part of this group. Please don't take risks that put the group at risk. You know, you don't want to be bored yourself, and you're here on vacation, and this is your trip, but please remember that, you know, that the group safety, you're part of that formula, and if you take excessive risks or lead the group into excessive risks, you know, we all pay the penalties, and we all have to, you know, potentially you lead us all into a negative situation. And the other thing with yourself and Dwayne, you know, writing the guidebooks and myself having a professional career in this, you also potentially put our reputations at risk if you know, or injured, or, you know, or worse than that, and things that, you know, relate to alcohol or drugs or just you know, plain uninformed decision making and heavy risk taking. So that weighed heavily on my mind as going into it, and I tried to put some things in our user manual, our community manual, and tried to set the tone with some letters up front about that and emails. It still came to a couple of times during the trip. There were some things that were riskier than I would have liked to have seen. There was a particular hike where we were doing kind of some free bouldering in a pretty risky situation from my perspective. But it worked out, you know, and I had a little bit of, there was a little conflict there where somebody said, well, you know, the whole objective of this is for people to challenge themselves. I don't remember talking about that.
How did you deal with that?
When I get stressed, and I was stressed in that situation, you know, if I'm the leader, I would, you know, change the situation and change the factors, and I probably wouldn't put myself or the group in that situation to start with, but I really struggled because on paper I was, you know, trip leader, but it was a common adventure. You know, we were all there as, you know, as adults making our own decisions. So I said my piece. I said that I didn't have to do those things because that was not, you know, I didn't have to do anything other than,
right,
you know, but, and tried to, you know, at least tried to make my point that what was going on was riskier than I was comfortable with.
Right.
And I really had to fight the feeling to either walk away because I didn't want to see if I didn't really want to see it, or to be there to, you know, help if something did occur, and it was a real challenge for me. And I don't, you know, I expressed it individually and maybe a little bit in groups afterwards as we went on, and I don't know if people backed off. There was one instance with yourself where we were hiking up Stony Creek where, you know, you'd asked me if I was comfortable continuing, and I said no, not for me, but, you know, you guys, that was your choice, and you guys stopped, and I actually felt bad because, you know, again, you curtailed what you were doing based on my risk threshold, but, you know, it seemed to work out, but it was a dance, and, you know, the term is common adventure, where we're all coming into a common activity.
I see.
The other category. But, yeah, it was a challenge for me, and it reminded me of a lot of research that I had done and some things I wanted to write on about risk thresholds and individuals and groups and different leadership styles. And those are things that I teach. So it was good. It was a good reminder and refresh and things for me. You know, sometimes you get stale as an educator. And
you know, it's interesting, sort of, or hindsight looking back, I think, you know, what were some of the risky things that I did? I went for a hike. You know, I wanted to walk up to the end of the camp, and having done that, I suddenly saw, gee, there's a little route here. I can hike right through that little cliff there. And then didn't go back and tell anyone where I was going or what I was doing. I was very aware as I proceeded that this was a stupid thing to do. And then there was another time at Lava Falls. We had run into another party. One of the people on that party had expressed interest in riding in my little boat through the rapid. And I had done that before with other groups, and I went ahead and did that. And so I was aware of thinking about risk. What surprised me, you mentioned injuries, we scouted lava, and I talked with one of the individuals who was going to go through that rapid about where to go and how the run would work. And that run didn't work out so well for that individual, who ended up getting ejected out of their boat and then hit a rock underwater and was pretty severely bruised. And so it was funny thinking about risk, and in a way we do risky things at times within the scope of our prior experience, and yet sometimes the things that happen are almost beyond our control. You know, when a person gets knocked out of a boat, okay, they sort of messed up their entrance and ended up going in sideways and some big stuff and got knocked out, as you would expect, or the boat would flip, and in that case it didn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, that
kind of curious.
Yeah, I mean, lava, well, a couple of things there. I mean, you know, if you're experience-based and you're hiking in the canyon and your past experiences of solo hiking, your ability to manage risk in that situation of your hike is much greater than, you know, than my daughter or my son doing the same experience. And that's something that I've always...
I see.
Conscious competence in terms of you've been in those settings, you know the place. It doesn't mean that the risks are less, but your ability to manage the risks and understand the risks and plan for the risks. Yeah, but letting people know that you're hiking is something that would have been nice. But
right,
and I had that with Kirk. You know, Kirk did the same thing. He went on a hike, and he just kind of disappeared, and I continually counted numbers. I was like, okay, who's not here? Why are they here? Where are they?
Where are they? Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, but lava, we all as a group had to accept, I mean, I guess someone who wasn't rowing a boat could have walked, and somebody could have walked back up and run their boat. We didn't discuss that. But, you know, when I looked at lava, there wasn't a quote, sneak route. Maybe it was Kirk had run the kayak one, but
he did great.
You had to accept the risk of whatever run you were going to do.
Right.
And those are the risks that are inherent in that rapid. And I think if somebody was really uncomfortable, you know, Mike looked uncomfortable, the fellow who, you know, had the incident. And I tried to stay close to him because he and I ran together, and I think, you know, he followed my line, which, you know, he's run the Grand Canyon 6 times. He's trip led on the Grand Canyon, you know, without the benefit of more experienced people. He should have had, you know, but if you assess that externally, he would have had the skills to competently run that rapid. But he really looked uncomfortable, and I'd never asked him beyond that. And he didn't, you know, he didn't volunteer it. So,
right.
You know, at
right.
that point, I think, you know, groups make riskier decisions than individuals. And
oh,
I think
interesting.
The fact that, you know, we're sort of all running the rapid, we're all accepting that risk, we're all running that left line, for, you know, one person. And I think there may have been a little peer pressure there to, okay, you know, it's your turn. I felt uncomfortable with my future daughter-in-law in the back of the boat, and but, you know, we had come through everything else. We, you know, we had an experience base of, you know, what, 12 previous days, and it looked reasonable. And,
uh-huh.
And I think Mike and our group realized the risks of lava by his injury. But those were risks that he had accepted, and we as a group had accepted. And we had the tools to address the issues. I mean, it could have been much worse, but we knew what to do afterwards to address the issues of that realized risk, the injury. I'm still, you know, go back and forth a little bit on I think the decisions were good after that. It's just I still wonder about evacuating him. But that was a group decision, and he was definitely involved in that decision. And I'm glad that it worked out.
Yeah, it's interesting. In even a leader-led situation versus, again, the common adventure, it seems like things can happen. People can fall out of boats. You know, there's a control for risk, which eventually is not doable. I mean, I guess you could say, all right, we're all going to portage this rapid, and then somebody's going to sprain their ankle or break their leg trying to portage the boats, slipping on a rock. So there's a fascinating line of adventure and risk, and what happens there. Of course, you could probably make the same argument for driving a car. I'm playing with my phone, and I run a stop sign, and boom, there we go. And we don't call that adventure. We call that driving, and we don't think it's risky.
Right. Well, they're calculated risks. And like I said, we had the equipment. We had an experience base. We had, you know, a 12 days of experience with positive results. I think the inherent risk of lava falls, you know, in all its reputation and all its glory there, that inherent risk, you don't want to take that out. You can't take it out. You could avoid it. That's one way to manage it. But we wanted to accept that inherent risk. And it's unfortunate that at least one person in our group realized the negative aspect of that, but that was a conscious decision. It wasn't an unconscious. He didn't float into Lava Falls thinking, oh, you know, this is an amusement ride. We're just going to come through the other side. He knew from years of experience paddling what the potential consequence was. And,
right.
You know, and unfortunately, it ended up going on the negative side versus the positive side. But that was a conscious competence decision, you know, that's what you do as adventurers. Now, if you know, my son had been in the driver's seat, that would have been you know, the wrong thing to do. It would have been negligent, really. But I think the way we did it, there wouldn't have been any liability because Mike had the experience base to do that. He was in a craft that he wasn't familiar with, but could have spoken up. So.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the game, right? That's the industry. That's why I have a job. I've talked to you about maybe taking students down the river at some point, and you know, to get the students now that I've seen it and know it, and I always feel very the guy I guide with or teach with doesn't feel compelled to necessarily go on every trip before he takes a group there. And I feel very strongly that that's important to fully assess what the scope of risk is. And I've always done that, which limits some, you know, I can't go places because I haven't been there before. But in terms of preparing students, it'd be a very select group of students that could go there, and there'd be quite a bit of preparation on you know, comparable difficulty before they were there, and we might shift to who guides the boat in that situation to manage that risk. That's not what everybody does. So,
you know, it's interesting in my experience of doing river trips in Grand Canyon with people rowing boats who have never rowed a boat before and who've never been on multi-week adventures outside before. The simple maxim, hit it straight. You know, it's interesting. I kind of wonder at what point does a familiarity breed complacency? And I don't think Mike was that familiar that he was running complacently at all. You know, these things happen. Mm-hmm. But he's sort of looking at the videos, of course, and these days everybody's taking film of everything and the YouTubes and all that stuff. Or the GoPro, little movies.
Yeah,
we can armchair quarterback and clearly see. Oh, he is sideways. He is not keeping this boat straight.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, why is that? Well, it's a new boat to him. It's a big, heavy boat, and he got turned sideways, and he might have thought that was okay, and he could just plow through that stuff sideways.
If you watch my line, he followed my line. We're talking about lemmings with the other group. And,
right.
He followed my line, you know.
No,
and he caught his bow and caught his bow in the same eddy I caught my bow in.
Very interesting point. Yep.
And at that point, I was at the mercy of the river. I could not straighten the boat out, and I don't think he could either. And, you know,
right.
You just
right.
had to prepare yourself for the hit.
Yeah, that's
I ended up staying in the
point.
Boat. Yeah, I ended up staying in the boat. He ended up not. So, yeah, I always this adage that Mother Nature takes care of the fools. I guess I'm not a fool. Mother Nature, you know, still took care of me and didn't take care of Mike. But you know, the people that have never rowed before, it says a lot about the equipment too. And
that's right. That's right.
You know. Very forgiving. My boat, the only reason I wasn't in the water like Mike is I had a very forgiving boat. And I was just fortunate. So,
yeah.
Anyway.
Hmm. Yeah. What else happened on the trip that surprised you?
Well, I mean, the joyous surprise of the river itself, I would just say, around every corner, I was blown away by the diversity of landscape, the diversity of you know, ecosystems, and just around every corner something unique and different. You know, hiking the canyon through Phantom Ranch, you get fairly isolated, and you know, you miss the grandeur of the Grand Canyon in this kind of little narrow canyon, but. You know, be able to come in that and then out of that into these large open canyon areas, which is phenomenal to me. And that, those were surprises. But, you know, I guess our discussions about wilderness and the Grand Canyon being a wilderness, and knowing that motorized craft go down the river and my different view of what wilderness is, I guess it was a surprise that there was so much interference in a wilderness experience from, you know, airplanes, helicopters, motor rigs, you know, coming to a popular trail or trailhead or, you know, Little Colorado and, you know, being there with 50 other people That was kind of took away from my experience, I would say. And then it was a surprise. I knew that we had talked about competition for campsites down there, and there you'd see other people. And on the flip side of that, we didn't really see a lot of other people. It was just these certain, reflection points, these certain popular areas that all of a sudden it was like, you're at Disney World or King's Dominion, where all these people, sharing the same wild location, which was not. But it detracted from the overall experience, but there was so much of it that was a unique experience for us as a group of 16 that
mm-hmm.
I guess it balances out a little bit. Depends on what what they're managing for and what people's expectations are.
Right, and that goes back to a subjective journey, and I'm sure that some people on some trips say, I come from New York City and I didn't see anybody my entire trip, even when I was at Havasu or Deer Creek with 120 other of my closest or certainly distant friends. So that perception of crowding can be it can be taken differently by different people.
Yeah, but
I certainly know it.
Extremely subjective, and
yeah,
But
as you say, I think as you pointed out, a lot of studies have been done on wilderness and what crowding in wilderness is, and looking at group sizes, no more than 11. As a big group in wilderness, average group size 6 or 7, as a more tolerable group size. Our group size was 16. We encountered other group sizes with a group size maximum of 32.
And normally, I was thinking about this morning, but normally when you look at a recreation opportunity spectrum and you look at zones of experience expectations, and the zones are generally exclusive, folks with a front country type experience, which I think a lot of those high volume sites or front country experiences are on the fringe, on the outside of the core would be a wilderness experience, a very individual experience where few people are in primitive trails and primitive campsites. And then as you get closer to roads, people have less of a wilderness experience, more of a front country experience, all the way to an urban experience. The river does not allow that kind of zoning because everyone, it's a roadway through all of that. So everyone is on the same pathway. So the interactions, the potential for conflicts, different, objectives, different goals within a resource experience, they're all right on top of each other. And you cannot separate those out into an opportunity spectrum. It would be difficult to do that with the Grand Canyon. And you could say, well, from a hiking perspective, Phantom Ranch and go out from there in sort of zones. But from a river perspective, I had it on the Maine Salmon. I wanted a non-motorized experience. The guy running his raft with a motor on it is going to go past me at some point, and that's going to, deter from my wilderness experience, my non-motorized experience. And there's no way around it.
Yes, and at Grand Canyon it's more complicated because the backpacker's destination, vast majority of people, is the river. And when they hike in to a attraction site that has 100 people there, what does that do for their wilderness experience? So it's definitely complicated.
Yeah, and the only way you could do it, I think they've done this on the Salmon with the Middle Fork in Maine, is if there was a takeout, and I guess Diamond Creek's the only one, this would never fly, is everything from Diamond to Lees is non-motorized. That's the zone. and everything from Lee's down is motorized.
From Diamond Down?
Or Diamond Down, yeah, excuse me, Diamond Down, and the two shall not meet. And right. That would be a way to zone that, but that won't happen. You know, as we've talked about, the commercial interests are too heavy, and the historical use is too heavy, but that would be the only way, or to create some other type of a midpoint put in. But even with that, you still have the flyover issues. That was probably the most disturbing. I think I wasn't trying to think of the name Cardenas. The Cardenas experience in a beautiful open valley with planes flying over until, you know, sunset, and then the first thing in the morning, that was very disturbing because that was a place where I felt like I had achieved kind of a wilderness setting, and then I didn't see on the river, but overhead, you know, nonstop.
let's back up a bit because you know, you were talking about zoning sort of from Lees to Diamond Creek for no motors, and then from Diamond down to Lake Mead as a motorized area. And I think one of the ways the park has tried to head in this direction is certainly with seasonality. After September 15th and before April 1st, there are no motors allowed on the Colorado River and Grand Canyon. So they've tried to look at that as a way of saying, okay, well, at least in the winter, it's going to be wilderness. but then for the helicopters, and laughing at that because, well, that means the rest of the year it's like not supposed to be managed as wilderness, and those motors are okay. You know, it goes back to the commercialization of a resource and the power of the commercial industrial tourism industry to manage the Park Service at their, you know, with lobbying pressure. The helicopters, let's go back and talk about that because there are helicopter flights over what's called the heart of the park, that Cardenas area just below the Little Colorado River. But then in western Grand Canyon, below Diamond Creek, that has gone on to steroids. And at that point, there's, you know, there's hardly any time when you're free of the noise of a helicopter either coming in or going out. Hours at a time. Were you actually referring to the Cardenas area, the heart of the park area by the Little Colorado River? Is that where you first experienced a lot of aircraft noise?
Yeah, I mean, after Diamond Creek, I guess I sort of expected it. I mean, I knew there was going to be more motorized with the Indian reservation. And I knew there were going to be helicopters down there, so I expected it. So my expectations were low. So it didn't actually. It did bother me, particularly the volume of it bothered me, and I was a surprise. But I guess I understood that I was in their region, that was something that was going to occur at some level.
Okay.
But up higher, you know, after kind of two or three days into the canyon, I sort of did not expect it up in that area, particularly, you know, when we pull over to camp at the end of the day and I'm thinking I'm going to be hearing the river and the natural sounds, and for, you know, four or five more hours, I heard planes and helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
So that it was more disturbing there to me than, because it wasn't expected, than it was below Diamond, where I was sort of expecting a different experience down there. Even though it wasn't a pleasant one for me, it wasn't what I was looking for, I realized that I was in an area that was being managed for other types of recreation, and I was, you know, more of a visitor, I guess, to their experience than them being an intruder on my experience up in the upper part of the canyon.
Interesting. Yeah.
But I'm very glad that I saw and experienced both, maybe not so much in the upper part, but in the lower, because it certainly tells the whole story and the volume, and I really think it's being exploited. I don't know how you deal with it, but, you know, having that, I don't think it destroyed my experience in the Grand Canyon, but it gave me a fuller version. And from my background and what I do for a living in terms of teaching recreation management, and both from a program side and a resource side, it really was instructive to me in terms of competing interests and management practices, and a lot of the uniqueness about the Grand Canyon with public-private inholdings and the reservation. So, you know, I was glad folks pushed to do the entire canyon.
How so? What will you take back to the classroom now based on what you saw above and below Diamond Creek?
I mean, you know, I've always taught about, I believe strongly in the recreation opportunity spectrum. There's a water-based one that Glenn Haas at Colorado State has put forth based on his work at some of the large reservoirs out west. But, you know, we talk about, I always have sort of this mantra of adventure is in the eyes of the beholder. The folks that are on those helicopters think they're on an adventure. And they are for them. You know, it's all based on your background, your point of reference, your experiences, your social group, what your comfort zone is. And those folks are on an adventure just as I was on an adventure, but they didn't match necessarily. So it just deepens my ability to share stories and share experiences that sort of exemplify that to people. For me, students in a college setting are, pushing the limits. They're stepping out of their comfort zone, pushing limits and questioning things. And that's how science grows. That's how society grows in terms of you don't want to be stagnant. And if I can kind of help them understand that each person comes to that conversation with their own background and their own expectations and their own likes and dislikes, just like, you know, me being in the upper canyon and having, you know, those quiet experiences on side canyons that I don't see anybody else other than the two or three people I might have chosen to come there with, versus those people who are flying out from the city of Las Vegas and the hideous strip to share a little bit of nature, you know, whichever way they can, with their helicopter ride and their step out for lunch or their little step in the boat. They think and they are pushing their limits a little bit in terms of what's possible. And they are engaging with the environment a little bit. Not the way I would like them to do it, but there is some engagement. What I would want to guarantee or want to see and maybe encourage the Park Service is to make sure that there is an educational component that at least tries to tie to the protection of the public lands and public access to public lands, even though it's certainly not a leave no trace ethic of any kind. But, you know, just to try to bridge a little bit of that gap and meet them where they are, if they are taking that motorized experience. So I'm not sure if that was very cohesive, but I think having both those stories and seeing it, because there are only a couple of places that I've ever had that kind of motorized. In West Virginia, we have the Hatfield-McCoy Trail. It's okay. The largest ATV network in the country, and you see hordes of people coming down on holiday weekends with four-wheelers and ATVs and UTVs on the back of their vehicle and leaving at the end of the weekend with mud all over them. And it's the same type of experience that I think you have from Diamond Down, is the Hatfield-McCoy system of West Virginia. That motorized, non-motorized conversation about perspectives and trying to understand a little bit more about that it is recreation, and how can you make that a positive thing in some way. I don't know how. I come from a very non-motorized background, and I'm pretty adamant about non-motorized recreation. But, you know, you have to say it is recreation. It is tourism. It's mass tourism. But is there a way to... Is there a way for the resource to benefit from both? And I don't know.
So you mentioned an educational component that you'd hope to see from the agencies about protecting public lands. Did you get a sense that Grand Canyon National Park was even approaching do-it-yourself river runners above Diamond Creek with that message?
I mean, I do. I mean, I took pretty seriously the materials that they had out there and the messages they had. The videos I thought were very good.
Okay.
I thought they really did make an effort to help people have that experience. And, you know, I don't think I'm unique, but I come with a fair amount of background to that, and I've taught it before. But I think even someone who had never been before, like my children and you know, relatives and folks who had gone on the trip who weren't that familiar, I think if they took it somewhat seriously, it was there offered and they reinforced it. I don't think that the even the Ranger talk, I think that there were some things about the Ranger talk that weren't very good, but particularly the first interaction was very, very I somewhat negative. The person came in, kind of stormed in with, you know, in this uniform, and I felt like I was, if I said something wrong, I'd be thrown in jail after I'd been tasered. But she softened up into more of that interpretive role, and I've taught interpreters, I've taken interpretive classes, I've worked with the federal interpretive program managers in D.C., and I think I know there's a struggle between law enforcement and interpretation, but I think if they would take that interpretive approach throughout, like they really have that interpretive approach in their video materials that are produced at their national interpretation center in Harpers Ferry that I've been to, I know people who work there, it was very high quality, but there was a gap between that and what we got at the put-in. So I think there's an effort there. I think that there's some internal things going on, and the internal conflicts between law enforcement and interpretation. I think the Park Service did a good job trying to get us that information. I doubt they do anything. You know, I've been to other concessionaire instances, Okefenokee, Cumberland Island, Everglades, where there's a step aboard program where a National Park Service interpreter steps aboard the craft and provides the interpretive message, or there's a required interpretive training for, you know, the river guides or the tour guides on boats. I don't know if that exists for those concessions. I'm not sure how it could, but I would hope that they could do something like that. And is there a kiosk? Is there an interpretive display at each of the Hualapai helicopter landing zones before they get on their boat that could share some of the information about the fragile nature of the environment and some of the conflict about motorized and why they do motorized. And I don't know if they've done that. I don't know if that would be people would be receptive to that or not.
Right. I don't know either, having not taken the tour.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, how can you say it's all bad if you've never done it?
Right.
Granted, in my gut, I can't do it, but but you know, I go on commercial trips just to see what they say, you know, and to see how they interact with the environment, see how they, you know, badmouth or don't badmouth the local population, and my job is to try to create the next generation that doesn't do those things, that, you know, really does value the resource and builds those connections to the resource. That's just how I am, and that's the programs I run. But
right,
but you know, hopefully I can be part of the solution in the future. So.
So now that the trip is over, I think your lunch date was on the 16th of July, and the takeout date was August 3 of this year.
Yep.
So you've been home now 5 days. 7 days. Maybe a little more than that. Any sudden reflections where you caught yourself in the last week or 10 days, going, I didn't think about that.
It took me, I don't know, I think it was just physical probably, but you know, for the first 5 days, every time I got up in the middle of the night, I thought I was getting up on the beach and walking down to the water. It was quite difficult to shake the lifestyle. In fact, I ran back to the field with my students this week and spent 2 nights in my tent and went whitewater rafting on the new. Just to ease my transition back into life, but I guess the thing for me, I'm not a very social person, and I guess I'm most amazed that, you know, for 19 days with 16 people who are mostly strangers, I can't help but think it's unique. I mean, I know a lot of people do that, but I can't help but think it's unique that, the chemistry of that group and people's willingness, I guess, to accept others or at least be tight-lipped. I am a day trip person, and I've always said I'm a day trip person because in the end of the day, I can send people home, and I don't need to deal with their, their personality so much. And I was really concerned about how that would work out. And I think for the most part, even in 19 days, you can avoid conflict if you really want to. And I think people wanted to, so that we had a positive experience. People who do 30-day trips or semester-long trips, I applaud them. I'm not sure how they do it. And it makes me think more internally about how better to work with groups and to manage groups. That's a skill set that I'm not very strong in, and I just think it was pretty remarkable that we were able to get along so well. But I also noticed during the trip it was, and from the pictures too, is people recognized others needing their personal space, and for folks to be able to wander off on their boat or wander on their own hike or just have a quiet moment to themselves is pretty important. To other people too, as well as me, and people respecting that. Again, I think it was, I don't know. I think it's unique. I'm having always introduced people to the outdoors, and mainly beginners for 25 plus years. The last 2 years with the San Juan trip last year and the Grand Canyon trip this year is to interact with people who are so comfortable. Throwing a sleeping bag on the ground and sleeping and, being wet, being dirty and having a smile on their face and going, yeah, give me more. I think it's a very unique community or just I've somehow missed an opportunity in my life to connect to those folks because I haven't had that before these last couple of years. Sometimes with staff, but never with a community of strangers who just kind of convene at a riverhead and just naturally take to it, and that's probably the biggest positive that I've had in the last two other than seeing two amazing rivers. Just knowing there's a community out there that loves being outdoors and loves the resource as much as I do is reaffirming that there's hopefully hope for this. These places, and these activities.
I'm interested too in one other topic, which is the concept of connectivity today with Facebook and with our smartphones and instant text messaging and voice recognition. I can talk to my message and I can make it's fairly simple communication. To bundle that all up and pull the plug on that for weeks. I think you might have been the person most connected to the outside with the spot device going. I know we had a satellite phone, but I don't believe anybody used it. Do you have any thoughts on communication and walking away from that?
Now, I was very reluctant to bring that inReach device because I think, I realized that second day I was very much ready to disconnect, and I disconnect often as I can. But I also am a heavy internet user and I've been a web publisher and it was that second day where you just gave in and said, I'm committing to it. We had the young fellow Clay who was, continually trying to see if he could get that text connection to the world. And I almost wanted to hide the inReach because I didn't want anybody. A couple of people asked, has anybody sent me a note? And my wife accidentally sent me a note. She sent a note that didn't have any meaning. It was an accident. And I didn't really want to send people's messages out. I wanted to kind of protect it
I asked you to send a message out to my wife, for celebrating the first of the month, and I kind of caught myself going, gee, that's curious. Why am I doing this? So what does it mean to have the tools available, and what does it mean to be able to walk away from those tools?
Yeah, it's why I stay in the field. It's what keeps me alive. I lived in the city of Richmond, and the river. I always say the river was the saving grace, because I could turn off the electronics. I could engage directly with the environment. It's what's been the pleasure of my life since I was a young kid, to be able to walk out of the house into the wild and into nature. And I wanted that. I need that to rejuvenate. And I wanted that. That's one thing I wanted from my family. And I'd taken my kids to Alaska to see wide open places, not be connected, and see the wild. And I wanted them to be able to experience that in the Grand Canyon, where they were disconnected from modern society, and get back to a connection to the land and places. And that's why I continue to do what I do, because I just think it's so valuable. We do a week-long, 6-day program with students, and we tell them they can't bring their cell phones. And they're like, parents call us, what do you mean they can't bring their cell phones? And the only thing that I feel badly about is that they don't have their camera to record some of their experiences. But I'm a big believer in storytelling, and to have stories that you can share and bring back, reach into your mind and bring back those visceral experiences of, rain and white water and new experiences. And new, I don't know, I just, Richard Liu's written his book on nature deficit disorder, and I just think that as a society, we need to keep those connections to land. So it was a welcomed experience for me, and I think a valued experience to my family, and I hope to everybody there.
Nice. Is there anything else you're thinking of that you want to include in this discussion that we've had, as we sort of start thinking about wrapping this up? I'm sort of thinking, 20, 30 years from now, somebody's going to listen to this interview. What would you like them to hear?
Well, I hope they do. I don't know how this would get used, but the first thing people ask me, probably one of the most amazing experiences of my life, and I want it to be. And I've been to a lot of amazing places, and I'd heard other people who've done some incredible things say the same thing about the Grand Canyon, and I know why now. And I hope it's there. I hope it's there for people to continue to experience it, because it's just such a unique thing. And it's just a unique blend of excitement, of human interaction, of human natural area interactions, the power of nature, the incredible power of nature, and feeling insignificant. I don't have much tolerance for large egos, and maybe my ego could be bigger because I survived Lava Falls, but it's not that. It's wow, I was graced with the opportunity to paddle through some of the most environmental power, natural power, and to be allowed out the other end to reflect on it. And we'd be a lesser species, lesser human race if that opportunity wasn't even there. Even if people, not everybody gets to experience it, but just that the magic is still possible. That's what saddens me most about where our society is today, and moving to more urban settings and not valuing public lands and not valuing outdoor experiences, and is that they don't even imagine that those things can exist. They just ignore it and focus on the things. And it's been such a rich part of my life. I hope that I can share with other people and encourage and help in some way that experience will be available in the future.
Nice. Yeah, it made me think about some of the writings of the supporters of the Wilderness Act back in the 40s and 50s, talking about traveling through large landscapes with a sense of humility.
Yeah.
And I think that, I have nothing on Lava Falls. It let me through yet again. That's very,
yeah.
Very fortunate and very thankful for that as a journey.
I think there's, I think we've rewarded large egos too much in society. I think that, Teddy Roosevelt, he was a big personality, and maybe he had a big ego, but I think he liked being in the natural world because it made him realize the place of humans in the bigger picture of things. And I think, right now we're talking about dropping nuclear bombs. I mean, we could destroy this planet in a matter of seconds, and it's because people have egos that, I don't want to get too political here, but I just think ego is too valued in society.
Yes.
So, anyway.
Yeah.
Great experience. I hope more people, I hope people get to experience it for a long time to come.
Nice. Stephen Sork, thank you very much for taking the time to participate in this Grand Canyon Historical Society oral history interview, part of Grand Canyon National Park Museum collection. And thank you again. I'm going to go ahead and stop this call now so that we can stop this recording on the other end. And but then I'm going to call you back.
Thanks, Tom.
All right. Thanks, Steve. Bye-bye.